York, this is Democracy Now!
I think we're on the way to getting peace. I think President Putin wants peace, and President Zelensky wants peace, and I want peace. I just want to see people stop getting killed.
As President Trump speaks with Russian President Putin and Ukrainian President Zelensky in separate phone calls, this is the beginning of the end of the war on Ukraine. We'll speak with the nation's Katrina VandenHeuvel. Then Elon Musk's business empire scores benefits under Trump's shakeup, with little to no oversight or transparency.
So all of our actions are maximally transparent. In fact, I don't think there's been, I don't know of a case where an organization has been more transparent than the DOGE organization.
We'll speak with three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Eric Lipton about the billions Musk has to gain as he fires thousands and slashes the federal budget. We'll also speak with Lipton about how early crypto traders had speedy profit on Trump coin as others suffered losses, and his story on what to know about the Trump family's deals in the Middle East. Finally, as Indian Prime Minister Modi meets with President Trump at the White House today, we'll speak with the acclaimed Indian writer Pankaj Mishra about India, Israel, and Palestine, his new book, The World After Gaza, A History. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, an agreement has been reached for the ceasefire deal to continue. After talks in Cairo, Hamas announced it'll free three more Israeli hostages Saturday. Israel had threatened to return to, quote, intense fighting if the hostages were not freed as scheduled. In a statement, Hamas said an agreement was reached on, quote, securing housing for our people and urgently bringing in prefabricated houses, caravans, tents, heavy equipment, medical supplies, fuel, and the continued flow of relief and everything stipulated in the agreement, unquote. Israel's continuing to escalate its attacks on the occupied West Bank. The Israeli raids have displaced more than 40,000 Palestinians in Jenin, Tulkarm, Nur Shams, and Al Farah in recent weeks. In Tulkarm, Al Jazeera reports 85% of the population has been displaced. Earlier today, Israeli forces shot dead a Palestinian man at an Israeli checkpoint south of Nablus. Israel also launched a drone strike on Jenin. Meanwhile, Palestinians have begun to clear rubble in the Al Farah refugee camp after Israeli troops pulled out of the area.
This refugee camp is targeted just like other refugee camps, and they want to plant the idea that you have to leave. It is obvious that they're trying to reduce the number of people in the camps or empty them, and they are trying, and everybody knows that, to end the case of refugees completely.
The BBC is reporting Israel's again attempting to push back its withdrawal from southern Lebanon until at least February 28th. This comes as the Israeli broadcaster Khan reports Israel's begun building five strategic outposts in the area and a sign Israel may try to keep a long-term presence in southern Lebanon. The newly formed Lebanese government has vowed to restore Lebanon's territorial sovereignty. In other news from the region, the Wall Street Journal's revealed U.S. intelligence agencies believe Israel's considering launching a major attack on Iranian nuclear sites this year. The finding was made by the Biden administration shortly before President Trump took office. The Journal reports the intelligence analysis concluded Israel would push the Trump administration to back the strikes. President Trump spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin for 90 minutes Wednesday. Trump said they agreed to soon meet and immediately begin negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. Trump then held a separate call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. This came as U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke in Brussels, where he said a return to Ukraine's pre-war borders in 2014 is unrealistic. Hegseth also ruled out Ukraine's future membership in NATO. In response, Germany and other European nations criticized the U.S. for granting Russia major concessions before peace talks have even started. Meanwhile, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has traveled to Kyiv to discuss a Trump proposal for Ukraine to give the U.S. access to its natural resources in exchange for continued U.S. military assistance. The Trump-Putin call came after Russia freed the American teacher Mark Fogel in exchange for a Russian jailed for cyber crimes. Belarus has also released three prisoners, including an American and a journalist who works at the U.S.-funded Radio Free Europe. The U.S. Senate confirmed Tulsi Gabbard as director of national intelligence. Mitch McConnell was the only Republican to oppose her confirmation. Democrats opposed Gabbard over what one senator called her, quote, bizarre fondness for foreign despots, unquote, citing her 2017 meeting with Syria's then leader Bashar al-Assad and past comments blaming NATO for Russia's war on Ukraine. Following her swearing in Wednesday evening, Tulsi Gabbard met with India's Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is in Washington to meet with President Trump today. Also on Wednesday, the Senate advanced Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination for health secretary with a final vote expected today. Trump's pick for education secretary, Linda McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment, is appearing before a Senate panel today. Trump's repeatedly threatened to close the Department of Education, calling it a big con job. On Wednesday, members of the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers rallied in front of the Capitol. They were joined by Senator Bernie Sanders.
We are not going to let them to destroy the Department of Education. Department of Education provides funding for 26 million kids who are living in high poverty areas all over this country. And we have the radical idea that maybe poor kids deserve the same quality education that rich kids do.
On Wednesday, federal prosecutors reportedly dropped a probe into Linda McMahon's estranged husband, Vince McMahon, over the cover-up of sexual assault allegations at the WWE. Meanwhile, CNN reports scores of probationary workers have been fired at the Education Department and the Small Business Administration since Friday. Eight inspectors general fired by Trump last month filed a lawsuit arguing their dismissals were unlawful and unjustified. Federal law requires the president give Congress 30 days notice and provide a substantive rationale before firing Senate-confirmed watchdogs. This comes as a federal judge Wednesday lifted a freeze on Trump's buyout offer for government workers, part of a plan by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to drastically slash the federal workforce. Some 75,000 workers have accepted the buyout so far. Earlier in the day, the newly created DOGE subcommittee held its first meeting, chaired by Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene. The Democratic Congressmember Melanie Stansbury called on Elon Musk to testify before the panel as she blasted Republicans for giving him free rein to dismantle government agencies.
Inflation is going up. You want to raise the debt ceiling by $4 trillion. You want to gut Medicare. You want to gut Medicaid. You're talking about going after Social Security after promising that you wouldn't. I mean, really, what the heck is going on here? We're not trying to take down Elon Musk as a businessman. This dude is literally breaking the law inside of the federal government. And for a party that is supposed to be the party of law and order, in quotes, I really do not see you holding him accountable and doing your most basic constitutional responsibility in the separation of powers.
In related news, DropSite News is reporting the Department of Government Efficiency has gained access to the financial management system used by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and is attempting to withdraw federal funding that has already been appropriated by Congress. Separately, DropSite News reported Wednesday, armored Cybertrucks made by Elon Musk's company Tesla are expected to win a State Department contract worth $400 million. House Republicans Wednesday unveiled a draft budget proposing $4.5 trillion in tax cuts and at least $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, including cuts to Medicaid and food assistance programs. The plan would also add some $3 trillion to the deficit over a decade and raise the debt limit by $4 trillion. Senator Elizabeth Warren accused Republicans of, quote, pulling a fast one on working people, adding, quote, make no mistake, this GOP plan will raise the costs that American families pay for groceries, health care, and getting an education, all to fund tax cuts for the ultra-rich. Warren said. The Justice Department is suing New York Governor Kathy Hochul and Attorney General Letitia James over state policies it says interfere with Trump's crackdown on immigrant communities, including a New York law allowing undocumented New Yorkers to obtain driver's licenses. The DOJ already launched a similar suit against Illinois. New York Attorney General James responded to the lawsuit, quote, saying, "Our state laws, including the green light law, protect the rights of all New Yorkers and keep our communities safe. I'm prepared to defend our laws," she said. In more immigration news, the New York Times reports at least 53 immigrants deported to Guantanamo by the Trump administration are being guarded by military troops rather than civilian officers. The Trump administration's freeze on foreign aid has led to its first reported death after a 71-year-old Burmese refugee was sent home from a hospital on the Thai-Burma border that was funded by the U.S. through the International Rescue Committee. As the hospital closed, Pekha Lau lost access to a life-sustaining oxygen tank. This is her son-in-law.
"Every patient was sent back home after the clinic closed down at the camp. Not only my mother-in-law, every patient went back home. Nobody was left there. My mother-in-law was not in critical condition when she returned home. I'm sure nothing would have happened if she still had an oxygen tank. She died due to the lack of oxygen tanks in the camp."
Other unidentified victims have also reportedly died after health facilities serving refugees from Burma were shuttered. The halting of U.S. aid has also compounded the already dire humanitarian crisis in Haiti, hitting a program that provides treatment to AIDS patients, including pregnant mothers, which has been put on hold despite coming under a waiver that should have exempted it. The Trump administration freeze also halted over $13 million in U.S. funding for an international security force in Haiti attempting to curb gang violence. Meanwhile, new report by Amnesty International finds worsening gang violence had led to severe and widespread abuses against children, including recruitment, rape, abductions, and killings. Amnesty said children with disabilities are particularly vulnerable. Romania's Klaus Iohannis resigned as president this week ahead of an impeachment vote over his decision to stay in power after presidential elections were delayed last December. The election was annulled by Romania's top court, citing Russian state meddling and pushed to May. Weeks earlier, the ultra-nationalist Calin Georgescu shocked pollsters as he came in with the highest share of votes, sending him to an election runoff. The family of Sonia Massey, a black woman who was fatally shot in her kitchen by a sheriff's deputy, has been awarded a $10 million settlement by Sangamon County in Illinois. Massey had called 911 because she was concerned over a potential prowler. Police, public health officials in West Texas have identified at least 22 cases of measles in a county with one of the highest rates of vaccine exemptions in the state. The cases appear to be clustered around private religious schools. Meanwhile, Nevada has confirmed its first human case of bird flu after a dairy worker became infected with a new strain of the H5N1 virus, which has been found circulating among wild birds. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has changed the name of Camp Liberty in North Carolina back to Fort Bragg, but there's a catch. Fort Bragg was originally named after a Confederate slave-owning general. In order to get around a law prohibiting naming bases after Confederate leaders, Hegseth renamed the base after an obscure World War II soldier with the last name of Bragg who didn't even have a Wikipedia page until this week. Meanwhile, more than 50 middle school students at a U.S. military base in Stuttgart, Germany, staged a school walkout during a visit by Hegseth to protest the Trump administration's rollback of diversity initiatives. And the new Trump-appointed board of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts voted yes on Wednesday to make President Trump its chair, less than a week after he announced plans to take over the famed cultural institution. The board also voted to terminate President Deborah Rutter and replace her with former acting director of national intelligence, Richard Grenell. Following the news, powerhouse TV producer Shonda Rhimes resigned from the Kennedy Center's board, while musician Ben Folds stepped down from his role as artistic advisor to the National Symphony Orchestra. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show with Russia and Ukraine. On Wednesday, President Trump spoke by phone with Russian President Vladimir Putin for 90 minutes about ending the war in Ukraine. Trump said they agreed to meet soon and immediately to begin negotiations to end the war. Trump then held a separate call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. After the swearing-in ceremony for the new director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, Trump spoke to reporters in the Oval Office.
I'll be dealing with President Putin largely on the phone, and we ultimately expect to meet. In fact, we expect that he'll come here, and I'll go there, and we're going to meet also probably in Saudi Arabia the first time. We'll meet in Saudi Arabia, see if we can get something done. But we want to end that war. That war is a disaster. It's a really bloody, horrible war.
President Trump also addressed questions from reporters about whether Ukraine was being sidelined.
Why is freezing out President Zelensky of this process a bit? Isn't there a danger of that?
No, I don't think so, as long as he's there. But, you know, at some point, you're going to have elections, too. You're going to have an election.
He says he wants security assurances, Mr. President. What does that look like?
In terms of what?
If the war were to end, he says he wants guarantees of security.
We'll see what that means. I think when the war ends, one thing he was very strong about, he wants it to end. And that's President Putin said that. He wants it to end. He doesn't want to end it and then go back to fighting 6 months later. We talked about the possibility, I mentioned it, of a ceasefire so we can stop the killing. And I think we'll probably end up at some point getting a ceasefire in the not-too-distant future.
Do you view Ukraine as an equal member of this peace process?
It's an interesting question. I think they have to make peace. Their people are being killed, and I think they have to make peace.
President Trump's phone call with Putin came as U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke at a NATO meeting in Brussels, where he said a return to Ukraine's pre-war borders is, quote, unrealistic. Hegseth also ruled out Ukraine's future membership in NATO.
As the war approaches its third anniversary, our message is clear. The bloodshed must stop, and this war must end. We want, like you, a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine. But we must start by recognizing that returning to Ukraine's pre-2014 borders is an unrealistic objective. Chasing this illusionary goal will only prolong the war and cause more suffering. That said, the United States does not believe that NATO membership for Ukraine is a realistic outcome of a negotiated settlement. Instead, any security guarantee must be backed by capable European and non-European troops. If these troops are deployed as peacekeepers to Ukraine at any point, they should be deployed as part of a non-NATO mission. To be clear, as part of any security guarantee, there will not be U.S. troops deployed to Ukraine.
This comes as Germany and other European nations have rejected any peace talks with Moscow that do not include Kyiv. Meanwhile, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has traveled to Kyiv to discuss a Trump proposal for Ukraine to give the U.S. access to its natural resources in exchange for continued U.S. military assistance. According to the State Department, Trump's envoy to Russia and Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, will travel to Germany and Ukraine in the coming days to, quote, engage with allies and partners across Europe who are willing to work with the United States to end Russia's war against Ukraine, unquote. For more, we're joined by Katrina Vandenhoevel, Russia expert and publisher of The Nation magazine. Massive developments in this last 24 hours, Katrina. Is this the beginning of the end of the war in Ukraine? And can you talk about the significance of Trump's call, 90 minutes with President Putin, his first, at least we know publicly, with him since he became president, also spoke with Zelensky and says first talks will be Russia and the United States in Saudi Arabia?
This is a monumental shift, Amy. Let's begin with the fact that Russia launched this war of aggression. But from there on, this is a monumental shift that, for example, the U.S. is not going to back Ukraine going into NATO. I think the defense secretary saying that has laid down a line that is in opposition to what we've seen for the last 17 years. That's huge. I think the fact that the sides are talking is critical, because for too long, it's been a militarized relationship. It's all been about Zelensky's weapons and then the Russian weapons. Both countries are war weary. The soldiers are demoralized. You're entering a period of mud and coming out of the winter. I do think the key will be the security apparatus or the security framework that will be discussed. The Europeans, Macron the other day called for 150,000 security forces or peacekeeping forces. That seems very unrealistic. I think a lot will depend on what kind of security architecture emerges to keep Ukraine sovereign free. There are elections that will be held, and that is mandated by the Ukrainian constitution, and Zelensky has declared martial law. But in the end, what we're witnessing is, and listen, I mean, Trump, I don't need to tell you how I feel about Trump, how the nation feels about Trump, but there is an importance in what he is beginning to do, which is open up a process to end a war, to move towards ceasefire. And I think that is to be welcomed, because the war is impoverishing Ukraine. The question also will be, with a country, Ukraine, that has some of the vast reserves of titanium and uranium, how those will be allocated to reconstruct a ravaged country, Ukraine, what role Russia will play. There are many, many questions, but the important thing is to get to a table, round, square, oval, and to begin to discuss, talk, 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 jaw, jaw, jaw.
And Katrina, if you could say, you know, these comments that Hegseth made and that Trump has reiterated, namely that, as you mentioned, that NATO membership for Ukraine is ruled out. Also, that a return to pre-2014 borders is not realistic. So insofar as what we know of Ukraine's demands, is there any likelihood within the negotiations, given what's already been said, that concessions can be made?
Yeah, I mean, I think the membership in the EU, which triggered this crisis in 2014, could be put back on the table. That's a one element. I do think that the reconstruction, the role Russia may play in helping fund reconstruction, is something important. I do think that Crimea and elements of the Donbas region may be put sort of de jure free, but possibly also negotiated into. That's very tricky, the border there, the contact line. We may see a kind of armistice situation that we saw after the Korean War. So it's left there. The trick is not to leave situations on the ground that can trigger, re-trigger conflict. The NATO issue, I think, is critical, because I don't know if people know, but it is basically a military-industrial complex lobbying operation. Members of NATO have to buy U.S. weapons. There's an interoperability clause. In the same way, these security conferences that Hegseth is at or was going to, these are military-industrial complex lobbying parties. So again, I come back to the fact, as much as can be demilitarized in the future regarding the security architecture of Ukraine, will be helpful and important for the future of the region. I know there's a narrative that if let alone, Russia will go into the Baltics, will ravage Europe. Russia could barely beat Ukraine, a small country. It's an anguish and horrible to watch what's happened, launched by Russia. We're 3 years on the anniversary. But the ability to talk and find a resolution, I think, can mitigate some of the fears of countries, which really have played a role in the debate, to the exclusion of those who argue that Russia is not an expansionist power. I know that will lead many to shriek, but it can barely take on Ukraine. It can't pay the pensions of thousands of people in other countries.
Well, absolutely, Katrina. But how then would you imagine that Russia could play a role somehow in the reconstruction of Ukraine, given its circumstances?
Well, there's a, there's a term that we've all learned in the last weeks, oligarchs. I mean, you know, there's a lot of money in Russia that could be used, but the extractive foreign policy of Donald Trump is well suited for this moment because, again, the minerals which Mr. Zelensky has offered as part of a reconstruction effort, they've already had. Penny Pritzker was the reconstruction czar, Governor Pritzker's sister, and she brought in Blackstone, BlackRock, our oligarchs, to help fund the reconstruction. The World Bank estimates it's going to be at least $1 trillion. And we know what happens when countries walk away. We've walked away from Afghanistan. We walked away from other countries. So I think there's a moral and political and security need to find resources for reconstruction.
Can you comment on the prisoner exchange? The teacher, Vogel, American teacher, after 3.5 years in prison in Russia being returned, in exchange for Alexander Vinnik, a cryptocurrency guy who was convicted. He's going back to Russia. And then you've got Belarus involved with 3 prisoners released, one of them American, one of them working for an American media outlet. And also the sort of passing references to Saudi Arabia being involved with that, not to mention it being the place where Trump will meet with Putin for the first part of the negotiation with over the ending of the war in Ukraine, though European countries are saying they wouldn't negotiate unless Ukraine was involved from the beginning.
So the first question, Amy, this is classic Cold War tit for tat. It's like the film Bridge of Spies. I mean, it's exchange of prisoners has been a long time scenario. We've seen it. And I, you know, what also happens seriously is obviously the repression of journalists, the arrest of journalists, the foreign agent, all of this. War is not good for progressive dissenting people. I mean, it used to be said you went on, became a dissident when you went on pension, but I think the dissenting community of Russia has been suppressed, not simply by the war, but by Putin's politics. Saudi Arabia, I gasped when I heard that they might meet in Saudi Arabia, the home of the oligarchical vision. I suspect they'll do Moscow, Washington in the end. But, you know, it reminds of how this war could have been averted. It could have been ended in March, April 2022, when there were substantive discussions in Istanbul. And there's been denial, but there's also been acknowledgement that Victoria Nuland, who was in the State Department, and Boris Johnson, who's Boris Johnson, came in and upended it, sabotaged the possibility back then. So they should take that to their grave.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, we thank you so much for being with us, publisher of The Nation magazine. Next up,
thank you.
Elon Musk's business empire scores benefits under Trump shakeup. We'll speak with 3-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Eric Lipton about the billions Musk has to gain as he fires thousands and slashes the federal budget. Back in 30 seconds.
Maybe the dark never comes to light. Shine as bright, treat it right. Though we will fall, but we always lose. Tied my shoes ready. We taught the fight, dress for fight. What if someone else believe in us? The fight never changed, cause they never played us even.
Wish I didn't have to climb twice as high for
the Even by Rachel Chinnaruddy and Kat Burns. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Dropsite News has revealed that procurement plans from the State Department include some $400 million to buy new Tesla armored Cybertrucks. This comes as Tesla owner and the world's richest man, Elon Musk, is already one of the biggest beneficiaries of U.S. government contracts and is now also the head of the newly created Department of Government Efficiency, tasked with slashing the federal budget and firing thousands. On Wednesday, the newly created House DOGE subcommittee held its first meeting, chaired by Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene. Elon Musk did not testify as Democrats blasted Republicans for giving him free rein to dismantle government agencies. This is Democratic Congressmember Robert